Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
What say you, Richard Ellett Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
I'm not here to work with them. Okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
We were grateful for that sentence. As Emily Limehouse pointed out in the courtroom, the judge is allowed to stack sentences. It's not particularly common, but we do think it was warranted in this case.
He stated his reasons in open court, which are really hard to disagree with. How much of that 40 years will he have to do? I don't know for sure. If he'll do any in federal court, it all depends on what happens to the murder convictions, obviously.
Welcome to Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdochs, Murders, Money, and Mystery. We are here to talk about Alec Murdoch's federal sentencing, which just happened in the past week. I am here with, of course, our exclusive legal analyst, Charlie Condon, our South Carolina's former attorney general. We're also here with Drew Tripp and myself, Ann Emerson. And thank you so much for joining us. We wanted to, of course, this has been a monumental sentencing, really, because the whole idea of the federal sentencing, from the way we understand it, was a backstop to all, to any chance that Alec Murdoch would ever walk a free man again. Charlie and I were both at the sentencing. Drew was hearing about it as it was happening. It was an extraordinary day again, mm-hmm. because we had. There was so much at stake in a way because everyone has sort of been living under this, can I call it a fear that one day that Alec Murdoch could get out because these convictions could get overturned. And when I say fear, that's coming, of course, from the prosecution, not from his side of the table.
No.
So what did you think, Charlie, when at this federal sentencing, was it what you were expecting?
Yes and no. I mean, the yes, in terms of I set the stage, what was upset, but I did not expect. The government asked for a 30-year sentence, and it seemed to me that Judge Gergel, since he gave notice that he was asking for what's called a variance from the sentencing guidelines, that he was going to be strict. But I was really surprised the government asked for 30, and for had the sentencing authority, the federal judge, to say, no, let's throw another 10 years on top of that. And he compared the case to Bernie Madoff's case, which I think is an apt analogy, but that surprised me. That was that strict of a sentence. And I think that's, I venture to say, that's going to be the strictest white-collar crime sentence in the history of South Carolina, I'm thinking.
Did he give any insight during the sentencing as to his reasoning or what he was... did he elaborate any more? That is something that I have that there's the ability to read between the lines, but not being in there and not, and of course, federal court not having cameras. What was his rationale?
You'd love this interchange because the defense attorney Griffin went through what he thought were comparable white collar crimes, mm-hmm. the recent sentencing of Freedman up in. I guess in New York City, he listed two or three others. He said these ranges are 15, 20 years, that's what we're asking for. And Judge Gergel interrupted him and said, leaving one out. And the one he left out was Bernie Madoff's sentencing. And then he went through a long discussion about his colleague on the federal bench, he went through how serious that crime was, and therefore that's how he got, I think it was 144 years.
Yeah, it was upwards of 140 years.
So he actually been a little bit equipped at one point in the sentencing, saying, I guess in a way I'm lenient because I'm comparing that to Bernie Madoff. I'm not giving him 140 years or so. I'm giving him 40 years. So that was the discussion. It was quite the back and forth, and it was dramatic, I would say.
Well, it was, and it was also, you know, one thing Gergel said, I had written it down, that, you know, the list of, when he was sentencing Alec Murdoch, he said, the list of thefts included your remarkable combination of extremely vulnerable, paraplegic, motherless children, grieving widowers. Access to these funds was made in a position of trust as an attorney for people who put faith in the defendant. This was reprehensible conduct and deserves serious sanctions. So Gergel knew where he was going with this, right? He knew where he was going with this when he got there. There's no way this language just showed up in the... Am I right?
No, I don't agree with that. And you know, he was a classmate of mine at Duke Law School. Judge Gergel was really intelligent. And I did notice that he had, you could say, 4 or 5 pages that he read from when he sentenced. So I'm assuming he had his law clerks busy. He was busy preparing. And I'm assuming also that nothing at the hearing changed his mind where he was headed with this, with a really, really strict sentence. And he also sent a real message to attorneys. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, I think, has been underreported. He made a big point of saying that he felt he had a responsibility to other lawyers in South Carolina and indeed the country to let them know that if you entertain any such behavior as this former lawyer went through, that you're going to get such a sentence and should get such a sentence. So he wanted to use the word general deterrence. So in sentencing theory, you have this specific deterrence where you're specifically deterring the person that you're sentencing, which in this case would be defendant Murdoch. But there's also this general deterrence where on top of him, you want to deter others. He relied very heavily on general deterrence of lawyers in particular for his very strict sentence.
Well, and that's, it takes me to that the planning behind this as well. We knew that he had filed an upward variance before we even got there. There was a lot of filings. There was a flurry of activity going on right before this federal sentencing.
Yeah, that was fascinating to me, too, because this gets a little bit complicated, but how this got mooted was so interesting, because before the sentencing hearing started, they were in chambers. Very punctual judge, 10 o'clock, well, no show at 10 o'clock. Everyone was in chambers. They came out about 20 minutes later.
I think I looked at the clock, and I want to say it was about 16 minutes later.
16 minutes.
They were in there.
So obviously,
but that's a long time.
Long time, because obviously what had happened, we set the stage here, is that the government filed a motion to hold the defendant in breach of the plea agreement for flunking polygraphs. Mm-hmm. And the defense was objecting to that. And the reason that was important, because the plea agreement had the sentence running concurrently, that is at the same time and not consecutively. And so the defense wanted it to be concurrent. So Judge Gergel came out, and pretty obvious to me in chambers, that he said, I'm going to sentence him concurrently. Mm-hmm. So there's no need to worry about the plea agreement being breached or not. And he later made a comment he didn't give much stock to polygraphs anyway. So that had been mooted. And so the defense got up, which was surprising as well. Talk about surprises, and withdrew their motion to counter the government's motion to hold in breach because it had been mooted, so to speak, wasn't important. And so that shortened, I anticipated the hearing going for a pretty long time,
right.
3 hours.
Yeah.
Since that was all important. So we had that off the table. So at the beginning, you thought, well, he's going to run it concurrently. Maybe it's not going to be that long of a sentence, and maybe the defense would get what they wanted. Oh, no. Au contraire. They did not get what they wanted. He got a really strict, long sentence. And if there's any way that the defense can overturn the murder conviction, with him having to serve a state prison sentence of roughly, we think, about 20 years or so?
Yes. Right now we're looking at, he got sentenced to 27 years in state prison for stealing the $12 million over 10 years. Mm-hmm. The plea deal reduced that to 22 crimes. 101.
Right. And I think
financial crimes got that down. So it was like 22 is what we were talking about.
Court.
Right. And so the question, I guess, for Murdoch was, okay, well, if you're going to run it concurrent, then that's not bad. Like, I can probably still walk out.
Yeah, no net time added.
Right.
Except that he...
It's 40.
Yeah, it's 40. So he gets...
on the federal system, you can get some good time off. I think it's 50-something days per year or so. Anywhere you look at this, he's going to be in prison unless he gets to his late 90s. Mm-hmm. He's in prison.
Yeah.
So that's okay. So I wanted to talk to his defense about that, mm-hmm. because I wanted to understand where they were coming in with that. Yeah, what's the hope? Like, where's the light at the end of the tunnel for Alec Murdoch at this point? We're in a defensive standpoint. Well, I guess there's the First Step Act, which would, in essence, lower the time again. The federal prosecutors, you know, are seeing that some of their cases, some of these convictions are getting lessened considerably. Mm-hmm. But the trick here is, where does he spend his time? And right now, he spends his time in state. Mm-hmm. And then those extra 20 years, right? Then those 20 years may be eligible for this First Step Act, mm-hmm. where they, on good behavior and everything, mm-hmm. would maybe lessen it. So that was the hope. Of course, all of this doesn't matter right now, because there's two murder convictions that keep him in for two life sentences right now.
Exactly.
So that is their first major hurdle, is they've got to appeal this conviction for the double murders. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, that will be happening in the next week.
I see.
They're going to have to go ahead and appeal that. Is there any point in appealing the federal, like appealing federally?
I mean, you can, you're allowed to, but I didn't see any grounds. So give him the long dissertation that Jeff Gergel had, what, 5 pages, and he made all sorts of findings and rulings. I think that's going to be a bulletproof sentence. And he knew that it was going to be looked at closely. And I'm sure if they look at it closely, his order is going to cover all the potential appeal grounds. I don't think there's going to be much hope there. Missing money, too. Wasn't that interesting, too?
Missing money is very interesting.
A big point of $6 million missing.
That's something I wanted to segue into is, Charlie, you mentioned the effect of the sentence as a deterrent on other lawyers and sort of the position from which Judge Gergel was approaching it and trying to send that message. And that was something going into the sentencing that the government showed their hand on a little bit, is like, hey, we've got this, we still got $6 million unaccounted for. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Murdoch was not truthful with us about the potential of another attorney's involvement in his schemes. Mm-hmm. So what new ground did we cover in the hearing on those specific topics? Did we get any more enlightenment? I mean, we know that there were, we talked about the polygraph, and that ended up, as you said, Judge Gergel didn't put a whole lot of stock in the polygraph, which is, by all accounts and what you read on those, it's great. But it's great that he didn't. See people kind of range in how they address polygraphs, from just pure bunk pseudoscience to unreliable at best. And then others, it was like, they do have their purpose and they are useful investigative tools. All that said, he says he's not going to put much stock in. And so what then were we able to get, where did we end up going on those two issues that the government brought up pre-sentencing about the other attorney and the missing money?
I really feel like the fact that Dick Hart-Poodling wasn't there, we missed a lot of potential information coming out. Didn't you think he'd be more loquacious?
That's why I felt like I had to kind of catch back up with the defense about this a little bit, about what was really going on. Mm-hmm. But what they did say in court about that was that, you know, one of the reasons they said he lied on his polygraph was, from what I could gather, mm-hmm. from what Emily Limehouse was arguing, Murdoch had remained adamant, as did his attorneys, that all these funds were spent on drugs. And it didn't add up. It didn't add up because the financials didn't make sense. Right. It didn't add up because he claimed he'd been using the same amount of drugs since 2008, yet the laundering escalated by millions mm-hmm. in the late 2019 to 2020. Mm-hmm. So they caught him in this sort of...
A lie
during the polygraph, which was one of the reasons that they were looking at that $6 million. So where's the $6 million? That is still being investigated, from what we understand, as is this unnamed co-defendant. But I think that will come to light sooner than later. I think that is one of the parts of the investigation.
No, I still, like, I mean,
absolutely.
The unnamed co-defendant being an attorney, correct?
I mean, it was. We couldn't see it because it is in the redacted polygraph. Mm-hmm. But it is in the redacted polygraph. So there is a record of them asking about this unnamed co-defendant.
Do you think that's the attorney they alluded to?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. I think that's the same person. So that's one part of this puzzle that has not come together yet for us. But does that kind of get to what you're talking about as far as the 6 million goes? Mm-hmm. 6 million missing. He talked about it again, Murdoch, when he got an opportunity to speak too, talked about how he became the worst thing that he always hated about other people, which is a hypocrite. Now he's a hypocrite. On top of other names that we could probably throw out there.
Right.
He talked about how bad he felt, and he would have never done this if he hadn't been addicted to opioids, mm-hmm. which immediately they called out and said, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that Griffin talked about, in the attorney, Jim Griffin, defense, talked about, you know, how this was a turf war going on between state and federal.
Yeah. Right.
You know, he immediately started off with, this is a turf war. We don't need to worry about this. This is just the feds wanting to get their pound of flesh for what happened as well. And Emily Limehouse had just such an important card to play there, I thought, when she said, hold on, there are 11 victims mm-hmm. who have not been named in the state financials, $1.3 million. That we know of, mm-hmm. and that doesn't even go into the whole 6 mm-hmm. million, you know, 11 victims right. that had never good gotten comeback. Their day in court. Mm-hmm. And she said, that's what this is about. Mm-hmm. This is, you know.
That was a good comeback. And didn't you sort of, when the defendant stood up and Judge Grokel said, take as much time as you like, didn't you sort of groan yourself, this is another 40 minute or so?
That's exactly what it was. I looked back at that today, and that went on for 45 minutes last mm-hmm. time, mm-hmm. where we had to have this weird back and forth right. between him and mm-hmm. trying to talk to the people that he had looted from. Right.
This is about 20 minutes, wasn't it? He didn't turn to any victims or something. It wasn't quite as long, but it had the same elements of being insincere to me.
And we had in the courtroom with us, so we had the Pinckneys, who we heard from mm-hmm. later. Justin Bamberg mm-hmm. was there. Eric Bland was there representing the Satterfields, right. who also, Tony Satterfield, Gloria Satterfield's son, was also there mm-hmm. to represent some of the financial mm-hmm. fraud victims. Then you see this whole line of lawyers from PMPED.
Yes.
I mean, they all came.
They were not
happy. Were they doing there? They just wanted to make sure.
Well, aren't they victims, right?
They are.
They chose not to speak, as I recall.
And they chose not to speak.
I didn't hear them get up. Even though the judge said he didn't want to hear from lawyers, he wanted to hear from actual victims. But they would have been actual victims, and I think they wisely decided not to highlight.
And Lafitte was there, the dad.
Yes.
Charlie Lafitte.
Mm-hmm. Charlie Lafitte was mm-hmm. there. Who else showed up? And so literally on one side, these federal courtrooms are small compared to what, mm-hmm. you know, everybody's used to seeing during the Murdoch murder trial. Mm-hmm. These are much smaller rooms. Mm-hmm. We got a larger room, I guess. They held a larger room for us because Girdle's normal room is even smaller from mm-hmm. what I gather. Mm-hmm. And that whole side was taken up pretty much by victims.
By victims, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was speaking about the lawyers, it's all former law firm. I know some people don't feel sympathy to them. I really felt sorry for them. I felt like.
Yeah, no, I do.
Felt like that they suffered a lot. And I don't.
And they paid out, too.
They did. And people think, and I don't know the ins and outs of this, but they think they should have found things out earlier. I don't know. But I did feel sorry for them being in the courtroom with them because it really looked like they suffered.
Well, I do too. And it was interesting that they were all there. It's almost like playing a game of Clue mm-hmm. because you know that there's this unnamed co-defendant who's mm-hmm. a lawyer. And you're looking over here and you've got this bank of lawyers who he worked with through this whole terrible period.
Right.
Yet, you know, they wouldn't be there if they were worried, right?
No.
Yeah. No,
they were victims.
They're truly victims in what occurred.
They're going to suffer a lot if you start thinking about it, because the firm was disbanded, correct?
Yeah.
And they paid out all this money, and you just have to think from a reputational standpoint. I know he's the one that's pled guilty, he's the one who's done it, but it must have been tough for them. It is tough.
The one thing I'm sorry that I missed seeing Judge Gergel in action. And I would like to, I understand so many of you listening and watching, you don't get to see him because it is federal court where cameras aren't allowed, you don't get to see his demeanor on the bench and the way he runs his courtroom and the way he interacts with the people in his courtroom. And I just, it's, we'll use, say, a Judge Clifton Newman as a frame of reference, or Justice Gene Toll, who names we've seen before, using them and what you understand about them and as a baseline. Judge Gergel, to me, he's an interesting dichotomy of how quick-tempered is not the right word, but he goes up and down very quickly, and it's in an effective way, mm-hmm. to where you, when you start coming at him with some baloney, shall we say, he is very quick. He'll raise his voice a little bit, and he'll you can just see that brow furrow, and he's looking down at you over his glasses, and he gets very, very impatient with nonsense. And then he'll turn right around and he'll just look at you with a big grin and the kindest eyes and the most soft spoken, and it's always very entertaining to me to see how quickly he can turn it on when somebody is just wasting his time. And I just wish I could have seen that in the flesh one last time, especially for this. Because to stay on that topic, the pound of flesh that the federal government is getting here for Murdoch, you hear somebody like Jim say, oh, it's a turf war. Okay, well, what is the state got to be upset about here? They just got a backstop. They got a fail safe. They got 40 years. He's not getting out of prison now alive, no matter what. It would be entirely mm-hmm. highly unlikely for him to get out alive.
Good point. Yeah, and Judge Gergel did have a good comeback. I thought, said, well, they're separate sovereigns that have their own interests to play. And Emily Limehouse came up with, I thought, really good policy reasons that she talked about. So that point didn't really go anywhere. He threw it out there, turf war, went nowhere.
Well, and to your point, like when, you know, one of the things was he wanted this to go the way he wanted it to go. Like Gergel had a plan as we went in and as we were listening to the victims, because of course the victims have a right to speak. The lawyers did not in this one from the former PMPED, but we did hear from Tony Satterfield. We did mm-hmm. hear from Ms. Pinckney. They did asked to speak to him directly, to Alec Murdoch, so they turned around and talked to him. It was very brief. Mm-hmm. They didn't go on. They talked about, once again, we heard some of the same things we heard in the state sentencing, which was words of forgiveness mm-hmm. and hoping that he kind of makes peace however he can. One group, though, that was not allowed to speak, really, were the lawyers who represent them. So that he cut off that whole part of it mm-hmm. for the federal court. It was not about the lawyers that had worked tirelessly mm-hmm. for their clients, these victims, but at the same time did not want to hear from them, just wanted to hear from the victims.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. But that shortened, in effect, the time for the sentencing.
It did.
And one other interesting legal point that came up, too, and talking about being quick-witted, Judge Gergel, the government talked about, we're asking for the statutory max of 30 years. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, one of those crimes had a statutory max of 30. But Judge Darrow quickly said, well, you can run others consecutive, can't you? So there isn't a max of 30, because he had in his mind, I think, going to 40, which they, of course, they had to agree with, that you could run these on top. He wouldn't be limited by the 30. And he did it. He gave 40 instead mm-hmm. of 30.
He stacked on like 120, is that how it worked, 120 doing, months?
I haven't read his order, but what he ended up doing is, yes, an even yeah. 40 years time, whatever that is, or 12 months, and a little backdrop on the federal sentencing, which is completely different than state. You start with the sentencing guideline, which under a case called Booker, which is not mandatory, but the judges typically they have them as a reference. And of course, guidelines like came up to about 20 years or so in the guidelines. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, so I'm looking at it right now. I've got, this is the way it came down to the very bottom. Mm-hmm. So it was 360 months for conspiracy to commit wire fraud and bank fraud, two counts of wire fraud affecting a financial, all running concurrently, 240 months for conspiracy to commit wire fraud, and then 120 months for 14 counts of money laundering to run concurrently to each other,
consecutive to the 360 and 2+ months sentences.
I said, and of course, you can't, if you plead to one crime and the statutory max is 5 years, even if the guidelines are 6, of course, you can't go to 6. You limit it to 5.
Right.
So he made the point that, oh, no, I'd go much above 30, and he did it. And he went, again, it's called a variance. You know, there's something called downward departures that are in the sentencing guidelines as a specific thing that you can do. A variance is just a general way to get above the guidelines that's not listed in the sentencing guidelines handbook, so to speak. So he let them know ahead of time, I'm looking at a variance, and boy, did he vary. It's almost like a double, I believe.
Yeah.
So, 6 hours.
If I'm doing my very rudimentary math correctly, it will, in essence, add an additional 12 years to his state sentence. His state sentence was 27, 85% parole eligibility. That's 22. 40, 85% of 40 is somewhere. So he's 34. Looking at about 34 years. Mm-hmm. 34 years, it feels like, at least. And I'm certainly defer to you on how that works with the 85% rule, the truth in sentencing rules before parole eligibility. So,
well, and how does it affect if you've got a convicted killer? I mean, it's like, I guess it's like a catch 22, really.
Yeah.
Like, if he got out of the convictions,
right,
then he's not a convicted killer anymore, right?
Right?
So then you're not looking at that when he goes in for his federal time.
Yeah, but at that point in time, he's in state court under the 85% no parole we have in South Carolina. So he's looking at a long stretch there.
Mm-hmm.
So if by some, you know, he lives that long and gets out, he's got this massive federal sentence waiting for him. And by the way, did you get a chance to look at the defendant when the sentence was announced? But I didn't catch much of a reaction by him. Did you see much in the way of stoic, wouldn't you say?
Yes. And I would have expected a little bit more, but no. I mean, I think that this, and this is what I've heard from the defense again, is he is ready to, you know, pay his penance for what he did in these financial crimes. Mm-hmm. He does not want to go down for these murder convictions. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're going to mm-hmm. keep, you know, ringing the bell on. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to keep on hearing
right.
about to okay. some degree.
And no family there, too. I thought that was...
No family.
Noteworthy.
Yeah, well, and no Dick Harpootlian.
Yep. You ever find out about that?
I did. From what I understand, it mm-hmm. was a conflict. There was just a conflict in the schedule, so he was not able to be there. But I did ask if he planned to be at the appeals going forward mm-hmm. for these murder convictions, and I have been told yes, absolutely.
I see.
So he will keep on going.
They do intend to continue representing him. That was included in... There was a filing. So one of the lingering leftover unresolved things that's still happening is there are some there's at least one outstanding civil case in the federal jurisdiction with the Nautilus Insurance that is still being litigated. And last week after the sentencing, Murdoch's attorneys, Griffin and Harpootlian, filed a default in that case. They're saying he's going to be in prison forever, and we have no means of recovering any of the money. He has no means of gaining an income, and we're not going to be able to pay any judgment in this, so just find us in default. But they did say in that filing that they will continue to represent him and continue to be answer whatever is needed to be answered. So, yeah. Also, isn't Jim Griffin the one with the federal experience? So I guess that kind of makes sense. You can't reasonably expect them to both be there every single time. And I feel like that's not the first time we've had a hearing where I think there was one.
Is that right? That other hearings were...
Well, it was just that this one was like
so big.
Final.
Yeah, so big.
I mean, this is the one where they lock the door and throw away the key.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hold on, where is everybody?
They all show up to where they just went in there for like an arraignment. I remember that.
They did. At the last one that we were in federal court, they had.
Back in September.
Yeah, Dick was there. So I was surprised, but mm-hmm. I did ask, and I was told it was just merely a conflict and that would be not the case going forward with the appeals that they would be able to get there. But yeah, it is also, I do think it is also partly who, and what is Gergel and Harpootlian's relationship? I mean, the last time it was awful, right? I don't think it went that great. No,
I wasn't
it?
There. Really,
I didn't go that well.
It doesn't stick out to me as being particularly bad or good one way or the other. So that doesn't mean anything. I've been to. This was the first Murdoch hearing I didn't attend personally in
3 years.
Yeah, it's a, yeah. And so
you and Dick were where? Oh,
for all of those conspiracy theories out there, Drew Tripp and Dick Harpootlian missed the same Murdoch hearing.
So to that note. The last time I saw Dick at the hearing in Columbia retrial hearing, I was talking to him afterward, and I've, like I said, been to as many of these press conferences and court hearings as anybody else, and I'm talking to him afterward, and he goes, "And who are you again? Who are you with?" And I'm like,
"Exactly."
Okay, so.
Somehow I missed you. I don't know
how that's possible. Just standing head and shoulders above everybody there, and
with the hat on,
and half again as wide as the rest of them too. Anyway, yeah. Well, I guess we can, as we're kind of wrapping up here, I can address that a little. I've already started a new job. I'm here on loan to help out with this. I'm still. Working with Ann, still based here in Charleston, still around, still going to have my finger on the pulse of the Murdoch stuff to an extent, but I'm not working for we're based with WCIV, ABC News 4 here in Charleston. So I'm not working for News 4 full time anymore, but I'm still around, still.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Appreciate it. I can't get too much into this just yet, but I'm, going to be a producer on a new venture, and I'll be able to talk more about that soon enough. Charlie, you remember this, and you remember this. You asked me last year about this time, was I going to CrimeCon? And I said I wouldn't be caught dead at CrimeCon. But I'm going to be at CrimeCon this year. So. Yeah, so
it's coming up.
Yeah, CrimeCon coming up in Nashville in coming up in the end of May, the first part of June. So I will be there this year, and we'll have some more information on what I'm doing then.
In other words, Drew will still have his finger on the pulse on not only Murdoch, but plenty of other things going on
related to crime.
More murder and mayhem that happens to be
crime that may or may not be true.
Exactly.
Anyway,
exactly.
We'll get there. But
well, great. Well, yeah. So we've still got a few things hanging out that we're going to have to keep an eye on. We need to see who this unnamed co-defendant is and how that's going to relate to these other crimes. We have a new date of when these crimes, according to the prosecution, started. The feds have said now that it goes back to 2005. Barely out of law school by then? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Is the grand jury still operating, the federal grand jury, on the murder situation?
The federal grand jury? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think that they're still... they're certainly still looking. They must be, right? Because they're still looking for that money. And they're not going to stop, because I think they even asked the question, what are you going to do about that money? And they said, well, we need to try. And we didn't even talk about the amount of money that they called for the restitution for these federal victims was upwards of $8.7 million. So $8.7 million, where is that going to come from? And they're hoping that somehow they're going to open the vault somehow and get the $6 million out. I think they truly do believe that money is missing. It's missing. So, I mean, and you know, after doing the work 2 years ago on this case, when we were looking at some of the related cases that have since been adjudicated, you know, we do know that there were opportunities possibly for that money within all of that. So I assume that's what they're still looking at.
And
Is that vague enough? I don't want to name any names right now, but.
You're switching subjects a little bit. Becky Hill, been following that?
I was there. That was the last official thing I think attended was the Becky Hill press conference in Walterboro announcing her resignation. I, based on all the information I've gotten and the what's public knowledge at this point, I think it's very unlikely that she does not face at least one criminal charge. And whether that be a misdemeanor or type of thing where it's just a short term of probation and nothing else, who knows? I was there at the press conference and they were adamant. As she announced her effective immediately resignation from the clerk of court's office, that it had nothing at all to do with the two current criminal investigations she's the subject of, one related to the jury tampering and the two related to abuse of public office for personal gain. If I'm guessing, pure speculation, pure guessing, I'm thinking the abuse of a public office for personal gain is probably the one we may see some movement in. Just because I don't know, it just feels to me like while SLED still says that it is an active and ongoing investigation for the jury tampering, I mean, that feels kind of, I don't know, final.
Because of what happened with Justice Toll?
Because of what happened with Justice Toll. I don't know. It could be more, but then you've got to have some sort of consensus from these other jurors. And there was, that was the point the whole time, is there was a broad consensus that she didn't do anything to influence their verdict, intentionally or unintentionally. I don't know. I'm just reading the room. I have no expertise whatsoever to really speculate on a good reason for that. It just has a little bit of a gut feeling there. So I think because then the other thing you still got is her son is facing a pending grand jury indictment for wiretapping. And we know it to be the case that was done according to what investigators have found. That was done in order to gain information for her. I can't say definitively that she was directing his moves, but she was somehow benefiting from his behaviors. Then it's hard to separate the two. At least in my mind, if you're an investigator, you'd be looking down that avenue pretty intently, gazing down that possibility.
But what about the appeals? As far as his appeals go, how do we see this play out? Like, if they reject his appeal on the South Carolina Supreme Court level, they could be back in federal court with that, right? They could be in U.S. Supreme Court.
They made it plain that they're going to try and get in federal court on some sort of federal ground. I don't know. I'm assuming, I have to think that one through, how they would have an effective ground, because it does seem like most of the issues are a matter of state law.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm assuming they can find some way to get in there.
There was an amendment issue, right? Weren't they looking at whether or not his rights were violated because it was, but maybe that was because of the jury tampering? Mm-hmm. Is that what they were sort of looking at?
I guess there's some sort of, that could be the way they go. I just think their best shot's going to be a state court appeal personally, just because of it was unusual the amount all the financial stuff that was in the murder case. That's unusual. Mm-hmm. Thickness are main grounds. Judge didn't let that all in versus just some of it or none of it. He let it all come in. We had, a couple of weeks of information at the jury trial and financial matters.
Right.
As a basis, like his ruling was, it was went to the motive, as I recall. So that's going to be, I think, a main issue, and that's going to be interesting to see how our high court rules on that.
But it could take a long time.
Yeah.
I have a little bit of experience with this. I mean, they don't really have a set schedule.
Right.
So sometimes it's pretty fast and sometimes it's pretty long. I would guesstimate on a case like this, a year or so, you have a ruling. Am I quite saying?
I can give a basic, from what I see, getting the weekly digests and alerts from the state court's office, it's not at all uncommon to see a case argued in October, argued in front of the appeals panel or the Supreme Court. Say you'll have an argument, you have oral arguments in October, and they'll issue a ruling in April or May or March, somewhere along in there. Of the next year, it could be, and that's after the case has been at appeal for already a year or more before they even get to oral arguments. So it could be a long time before the Murdoch's murder appeal gets, we get any significant movement there. And on that note, we also have still dangling out there is his co-conspirator, Corey Fleming, his appeal of his pleaded, his negotiated sentence and plea agreement. He's appealing that, saying Judge Newman was biased and too harsh. And then there's Russell Lafitte, who has not been charged or who has not been tried in state court, but he's still got his federal appeal pending, and that just at the end of March, the federal government filed their response to his appeal and their cross appeal. In that case, going after more restitution, basically interest on the restitution that they feel Lafitte should owe, and that I believe Judge Gergel did not order interest on some of what he owed in his sentencing. But so that's coming up in. We're going to start thinking in years now and not weeks and days and months. So a lot of stuff to still.
Yeah. And of course it's a Murdoch case. So I'll see y'all next week, right?
So, we're still waiting on that other killer the real killer.
The empty chair.
Jim
Where's
Griffin.
Empty
and
chair theory, right?
Dick Harpootlian teased at the retrial hearing back in January. Still waiting on that.
Well, we'll certainly keep everything. We'll keep our ear to the ground, of course, as this carries on. There are plenty of opportunities to update this story over the next months and years. So we've been doing it for 3 years for you guys, so we will keep on letting you know what's going on with it. But in the meantime, for now, I want to say thank you so much. Max Harrison, our chief photographer here at CIV, has been taking care of the camera production, the music that you love, all of that, which has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Charlie Condon.
My pleasure.
Our exclusive legal analyst here. We are so lucky to have your expertise, to have him next to me in that courtroom, and to be able to walk out and take it apart. It's just been invaluable. Drew Tripp, such a joy. So excited to see what you do next. But know that... I will absolutely be rapping hard on your door if something happens with Murdoch, because I know they're all, it's not just me, it's not my fault. There's a bunch of people out there that want to hear what you have to say about it. So we'll keep you all up to speed. I'm Ann Emerson. So for now, Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdoch's Murders, Money, and Mystery. We will talk to you soon. Thanks.